Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Friday, June 18th.
Throughout history, Juneteenth has been known by many names. Jubilee Day, Freedom Day, Liberation Day, Emancipation Day, and today, a national holiday.
And that, of course, was Vice President Kamala Harris speaking yesterday as President Biden signed legislation to make Juneteenth, June 19th, a federal holiday to commemorate the end of slavery in the United States. It's the first new national holiday established since Martin Luther King Day, way back in 1983. With me now is Atlantic staff writer and award-winning poet Clint Smith. He's written a new book with a very timely and simple conceit. He crossed the country visiting 9 monuments and other places that have a historical link to the legacy of slavery and wrote about how those places memorialize or distort that connection. From Thomas Jefferson's Monticello to the African burial ground in Lower Manhattan to a Juneteenth celebration in Galveston, Texas, the scene of the actual Juneteenth story. Clint Smith's new book is called How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. Hi, Clint. Welcome back to WNYC. Thank you so much. You must be in such demand today, so thank you for giving us some time on this holiday.
I'm so happy to be here.
Tell us more about why you wanted to write about sites in particular that were major places in the history of slavery.
Yeah, so the origin story of this book is that I was watching the several Confederate statues come down in my hometown in New Orleans, statues to Robert E. Lee, P.G.T. Beauregard, Jefferson Davis, and I was thinking about what it meant that I grew up in a majority black city in which there were more homages to enslavers than there were to enslaved people. And what does that mean? Like, what does it mean that to get to the grocery store, I had to go down Jefferson Davis Highway? To get to school, I had to go down Robert E. Lee Boulevard? That my middle school was named after a leader of the Confederacy? That my parents still live on a street named after somebody who owned 150 enslaved people? And because we know that symbols and monuments and memorials aren't just symbols. They are reflective of the stories that people tell. And those stories embed themselves into the narratives that communities carry. And those narratives shape public policy, and public policy shapes the material conditions of people's lives. So it's not to say that taking down a statue of Robert E. Lee or making Juneteenth a holiday is going to erase the racial wealth gap. But it is to say that these are all part of an ecosystem of ideas and stories that shape how we understand what has happened to communities and what communities deserve. And so I was thinking a lot about how New Orleans, my hometown, was reckoning with or failing to reckon with its relationship to the history of slavery. And then I sort of started broadening it out more, thinking about how other places across the country were running from or directly confronting their relationship to this history or doing something in between. And so I ended up going to 9 different places across the country that represent a sort of patchwork of different experiences, places from Angola Prison in Louisiana to the Blanford Cemetery in Petersburg, Virginia, one of the largest cemeteries in the country, and trying to get a sense of how these different places tell such different stories about this common history that we share.
So let's go through some of these. And I wonder if you could take us first to Galveston, Texas. And I think you've agreed with my producer that you would read a passage from you attending a Juneteenth 1865 reenactment. Do you have this? And can you set up where we are and what we're about to hear?
Yeah, so this is, we are in Galveston, Texas. And I went to Galveston 2 years ago for the annual celebration that community has to celebrate both Juneteenth and the late Al Edwards Sr., who was the state legislator in Texas, who 40 years prior had made possible and advocated for the legislation that made Juneteenth into a state holiday in Texas. And so this was just a year before he would pass away. He passed away last year. And it is a moment in which there was such an intimacy to the way that Juneteenth was celebrated. It was very clear for this community that this was not a performance or just a symbol or just a day, that this was these were descendants of people whose ancestors had heard that they were free on this day. And so there, this was a part of their lineage. This was an heirloom that had been passed down, and it was clearly something very personal for them. And so what I'm about to read is there's a guy named Stephen Duncan who is part of what they do is have Union soldier reenactors who read and Stephen Duncan pretends to be General Gordon Granger, the Union general who came down and announced General Order Number 3, which said that all slaves are free.
Thank you for that setup. We're all ears.
Stephen looked down at the parchment, appraising the words as if he had never seen them before. He looked back down at the crowd, which was looking up at him. He cleared his throat, approached the microphone, and lifted the yellowed parchment to eye level. The people of Texas are informed that, in accordance with proclamation of the Executive of the United States, all slaves are free. That involves an absolute equality of personal rights and rights of property between former masters and slaves, and the connection heretofore existing between them becomes that between employer and hired labor. The freedmen are advised to remain quietly at their present homes and work for wages. They are informed that they will not be allowed to collect at military posts and that they will not be supported in idleness either there or elsewhere. All slaves are free. The four words circled the room like birds that had been separated from their flock. I watched people's faces as Stephen said these words. Some closed their eyes. Some were physically shaking. Some clasped their hands with the person next to them. Some simply smiled, soaking in the words that their ancestors may have heard more than a century and a half ago. Being in this place, standing on the same small island where the freedom of 250,000 people was proclaimed, I felt the history pulse through my body.
That was Clint Smith, if you're just joining us, reading from his new book, How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. Clint, maybe remind us even more, or for people just even becoming familiar with the basics of Juneteenth, and I think there are probably many millions of Americans still, how Galveston, Texas is central to the story. A lot of it was in that passage and your setup, but just maybe do a little bit of Juneteenth 101 in that respect.
Yeah, so Juneteenth is June 19th, 1865, when General Gordon Granger of the Union Army arrived in Galveston, Texas, and proclaimed through General Order Number 3, as I said in the passage, that all slaves are heretofore free. And the context of this is that this was 2.5 years after Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation. And this is 2 months after Robert E. Lee surrendered at Appomattox Courthouse, effectively ending the Civil War. And so what happened is that so many enslavers from places like Virginia and the Carolinas and places in these sort of upper places that were more proximate to the North and places that in many ways the Union Army had taken over, many of those enslavers took their chattel, took their human property to Texas because they figured rightfully that Texas would be among the last places to be reached by the Union Army, and thus the Emancipation Proclamation, which only applied to Confederate states, would not be enforced, because the only way that obviously the Union Army could enforce the Emancipation Proclamation in the Confederacy is if Union forces were in control of that territory. And so you had tens of thousands of additional enslaved people who came to Texas, and ultimately ended up with 250,000 enslaved people in 1865 who were there. And so Juneteenth is this moment in which we both mourn the fact that freedom was kept from hundreds of thousands of people who had rightfully attained it, both through the Emancipation Proclamation and after the Civil War was effectively over 2 months prior. And we mourn that was kept from them, but we also celebrate this symbol that represents the end of one of the most egregious things that this country has ever done. And so Juneteenth is a moment of sort of both andedness. And for me personally, part of what I think about is how slavery existed for 250 years in this country. And from the moment enslaved people were brought to these shores, they were fighting for freedom. And so what that means is that the vast majority of people across generations, millions of people who fought for freedom, who resisted slavery in ways big and small, never got a chance to see that freedom for themselves. But they fought for it anyway because they knew that at someday someone would. And I think that that's a lesson that we carry today, is that we fight to build a better world and a more equitable world and a more just world, not necessarily or singularly so that we can see it for ourselves, but because we are part of a tradition and a lineage of people who fight for something to make a better world for those we might not even have the opportunity to meet.
Through the process of writing this book, you found out that your grandfather's grandfather was enslaved. How did you find that out, and what did you learn about him?
Yeah, I mean, I spent about 4 years writing this book, and I had been spending, you know, so much time with scholarship on the history of slavery and interviewing people at these different historical sites about their relationship to the history of slavery, how they taught about it, how they curated the experience, how it fit into their lives. And I had this moment about halfway through in which I realized that I had done more sort of interviewing of strangers and had a better sense of how strangers' lives fit into this history than I did some of the people close to me. And so I sat down and interviewed both my grandmother and my grandfather. My grandfather born in 1930, Jim Crow, Mississippi, and my grandmother born in 1939, Jim Crow, Florida, to get a sense of what their experience growing up in these places were like, and also to get a sense of how their lives, you know, when they were born, which were only a few decades past abolition, you know, 1930 is only, 65 years after the abolition of slavery. And that is the world in Mississippi that my grandfather was born into. And part of what it did was ground me in our sort of temporal proximity to this period of time. Like I said, slavery existed for 250 years in this country and is only not existed for a little over 150. And so you have this institution that existed almost a century longer than it hasn't. And you have the woman who opened the National Museum of African American History and Culture alongside the Obama family, the new Smithsonian, in 2016. The woman who opened it was the daughter of an enslaved person, not the granddaughter or the great-granddaughter. She was the daughter of someone who had been born into intergenerational chattel bondage. My grandfather's grandfather, as you said, was enslaved. And so when my 4-year-old son sits on my grandfather's lap, I imagine my grandfather sitting on his grandfather's lap. And I'm reminded that this history we tell ourselves was a long time ago, wasn't that long ago at all. And in the scope of human history, it was just yesterday. And so that's important because the more we collectively realize our proximity to that period of time, and the more we realize how it wasn't that long ago, the more effectively we're able to identify how that period of time and all that it produced shaped what our contemporary landscape of inequality looks like and shaped what our political, economic, and social infrastructure look like. And that is deeply important if we are going to fully account for what has been done to certain communities over time and how to effectively make amends for the harm that was done.
And after that reenactment of Juneteenth in Galveston that you attended, you watched the rest of the proceedings, or I should say after the reenactment itself came the rest of the proceedings, which involved children performing a history lesson, moving through some dates that are central to the story of slavery in the United States. And you write, "I felt in that moment envious of them. Had I known when I was younger what some of the students were sharing, I felt as if I would have been liberated from a social and emotional paralysis that for so long I could not name," that from your book. Can you talk about that unnamable paralysis, and have you found a name for it? Because I think it's an animating force for this project, right?
Yeah, it's an animating force for this project. It's an animating force for so much of my work, I think. I think so much of what I'm attempting to do with this book is fill in the gaps that, to my mind, should have been filled a long time ago. I mean, I remember growing up in New Orleans, you know, a young black child in New Orleans, being inundated with these messages about how New Orleans was the murder capital of the nation, how we incarcerate more people per capita in Louisiana than China, Iran, and Russia, how there's the sort of the culture of the projects and poverty was reflective of the laziness or violence embedded within a community. And I knew that these things were wrong, right? Like, I knew these sort of, you know, to the extent that they were even implicit commentaries on black life in New Orleans, I knew that what I was hearing was wrong, but I didn't know how to say it. I didn't have the language. I didn't have the toolkit. I didn't have the history. I didn't have the sociology. I didn't have the framework to effectively push back against what I was hearing. And I think what happens is that you know something is wrong, but you don't know how to say it's wrong. And so I experienced a sort of psychological and emotional paralysis. And the worst manifestation of that is that you, because you don't have the tools to push back against it, you, many young people begin to internalize it, and begin to internalize the messages that this country tells them about themselves. And I think what this book does, is an attempt to do, is to give myself the language and the toolkit and the framework to more effectively understand how slavery shaped what our society looks like today, and to teach myself, you know, some of the things that I should have learned in eighth grade history class, like these things that are just so central to us understanding what this country is. And so, you know, the book is written as a journey of learning. Like, this is not a book that was written by someone who began this project as an expert on the history of slavery. The book itself is a literal journey of me going to different places to try to understand this thing that I wish I had understood more effectively a long time ago.
And one of the sites you visited as you went to historical sites around the country was a Memorial Day event at the cemetery organized by the Sons of Confederate Veterans. And I will say that you will raise readers' blood pressure with this chapter because your presence was felt and not necessarily welcome. So can you describe that experience?
Yeah, so I went to Blandford Cemetery. It is one of the largest Confederate cemeteries in the country, a place where over the remains of over 30,000 Confederate soldiers are buried. And I was there for the Sons of Confederate Veterans Memorial Day celebration. And so, as you alluded to, I was a conspicuous presence, if you will. And part of what I learned, it was a deeply unsettling experience in many ways. And I was very clearly being recorded on people's phones. People turned around and were taking pictures of me under the guise of attempting to intimidate or subtle, not so subtly threaten me or make me feel unwelcome. But I went up to several Confederate reenactors, neo-Confederates, people who were dressed in Confederate garb, engaged in this sort of reenactment and holiday procession. And what it did was these conversations helped give me a deeper clarity about how the contemporary manifestation of the Lost Cause comes to be. And the Lost Cause, for those who might be unfamiliar, is the idea, a sort of narrative propagated following the Civil War, that the Civil War by the Confederacy, by the South, that the Civil War was not actually about slavery, that slavery was, and that slavery itself was not even the sort of malevolent institution that we think of, that it was actually a benevolent institution. There were many benevolent slave owners, that it was, as late Senator John Calhoun of South Carolina said, that it was a positive good for both black and white people alike. Or as the historian Ulrich B. Phillips, one of the sort of leading historians in the early 20th century, said that it was a civilizing institution for black people and sort of rescued them from the savagery of Africa. And so that was the sort of predominant view of what slavery was for a century after the end of the Civil War until the Civil Rights Movement. And you had historians like Kenneth Stamp sort of help us recalibrate our understanding of what slavery was and ground the black-white inequality we saw in the mid-20th century in the history of slavery. And when I'm having these conversations with these Confederate veterans, it became clear that for so many people, history is not about empirical evidence or primary source documents or historical fact. It is a story that people tell, and it is a story that they are told. It is an heirloom that's passed down over generations, and it is deeply entangled in their sense, their relationships, and their sense of who they are in the world. So one guy I was talking to named Jeff talked about how his grandfather used to bring him to the cemetery, and they would sit in the gazebo, and his grandfather would sing him these songs of the Confederacy. They would sing the Dixie song. He would tell him these stories about the brave men buried in the cemetery who fought to keep Virginia safe from the sort of violent, aggressive North. Who was attempting to impose their way of living onto Virginians.
Does he erase slavery from the story in that telling to his kid, or excuse it, or do you know?
he says slavery existed, but the war wasn't about slavery. Slavery had almost little, if anything, to do with it. This was about Northern aggression. This was about states' rights. This was about our ability to decide who we wanted to be for ourselves, which, of course, it was about states' rights. It was about a state's right to decide whether or not they wanted to keep enslaved people. Right. And part of the insidiousness of white supremacy and the insidiousness of what we see now is that it attempts to turn empirical statements into ideological ones. So if I say the Confederacy was a treasonous territory that raised an army predicated on maintaining and expanding the institution of slavery, in today's political climate, in some spaces, if I were a teacher saying that, that would be me being perceived as attempting to indoctrinate my students with my political beliefs. That would be considered an ideological statement. But it is, in fact, one that is just grounded in historical evidence. All you have to do is look at the Declarations of Confederate Secession of 1861, where a state like Mississippi said that, quote, our position is thoroughly aligned with the institution of slavery, the greatest material interest in the world. Mm-hmm. Right. So we don't have to guess why they were seceding from the Union and about to fight the Civil War. They said so for themselves. But in Blandford, there is a rejection of that because it what happens is if they accept that reality, then it completely decimates and crumbles their sense of who their family is and thus their sense of who they are.
Ginger in Bronxville, you're on WNYC with Clint Smith. Hi, Ginger.
I called in. I'm actually a native Texan that lives in New York. I'm a Juneteenth descendant on both sides of my family and had planned a celebration of my own tomorrow, a barbecue in my backyard, and I plan to do Miss Opal's virtual 2.5 mile walk. And of course, you know, the tide has really turned. But I had mixed feelings. I started out with Annette Gordon-Reed's possessiveness about the holiday and fears that it would be exploited and be more of a performative thing than the really serious event that it is back home. I've gotten over that. I'm overjoyed about the holiday. But as you all have discussed, my great-great-grandfather registered to vote in Davis County, Texas in 1867, the year after the Juneteenth. And we're still fighting for voting rights. We are. And also Governor Abbott is working to erase the history of my entire family's experience in the state. My mom was on the Texas Historical Commission and worked on the Dallas Freedmen Cemetery Project. And so this is really concerning to me as well. So it's a mixed feeling because I'm overjoyed that we'll have the holiday to have a teaching moment and opportunity. And it's something that all of us can celebrate and share in. But by the same token, it feels a little hollow because we're fighting the substantive fight for what emancipation is supposed to mean.
Ginger, thank you so much. And a last thought, Clint, in response to Ginger and anything else you want to say, maybe how, having written this book and just being who you are, you're going to observe Juneteenth today or tomorrow?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we have to hold space for both of those feelings, right? We hold space for a recognition that this will be used by some people as something performative, as something that they do at the expense of or in lieu of meaningful material change or recalibration of their values. But also that, you know, that's not something that we have control over. What we can control is the way that we honor and tell the story of this holiday. And hopefully that this serves as an entry point into a continued recalibration of our collective consciousness around what slavery was. And again, how recent it was. Again, that this was, you know, she mentioned her great-great-grandfather, that this wasn't that long ago. We talk about slavery. The way I learned about slavery in elementary school was as if it happened in the Jurassic era, that it was like the dinosaurs and the Flintstones and slavery, almost as if they existed at the same time. But this was so recent, and this history is not that long ago. And I hope that for me, that is what I will be grounding myself in today and tomorrow, is a reminder that this wasn't that long ago, and that there were so many people, again, over generations, who fought to make this possible. And what responsibilities does that bestow on me moving forward to create the sort of an even better world for my own descendants?
And listeners, if you want to know about some of the other sites that Clint visited for his book, how He measured change at Jefferson's Monticello and says things are changing for what tourists see there, how he visited the Angola, Louisiana State Penitentiary, a former plantation where inmates currently pick cotton under the supervision of correctional officers, or what he looked at in New York City in particular, or in Senegal. You'll just have to read his book, which is called How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. Clint, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow, part two of our Juneteenth special on the podcast with Elizabeth Alexander and her article, This is How We Can Envision Black Freedom. Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.